Today is Tuesday, April 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the World Health Organization warns the global community not to let their guard down against COVID-19.
The pandemic is far from over.
The environmental implications of the planet on lockdown. Also ahead, how virtual reality is helping elderly citizens cope with immobility of all kinds. It's all on today's International Edition. The head of the World Health Organization warned on Monday that the new coronavirus pandemic is far from over.
WHO continues to be concerned about the increasing trends in Africa, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and some Asian countries.
And on this World Immunization Week, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said shortages of vaccines against other diseases are being reported in 21 countries as a result of border restrictions linked to the pandemic. He says he is deeply concerned about the impact of the disruption of normal health services, especially on children.
Children may be at relatively low risk from severe disease and death from COVID-19, but can be at high risk from other diseases that can be prevented with vaccines.
Tedros warned that the number of malaria cases in sub-Saharan Africa could double. The United Nations International Children's Fund, or UNICEF, reports over 13 million children worldwide did not receive any vaccines at all in 2018. As the coronavirus further impacts immunization rates. Joining us to talk about it is Robin Nandy, UNICEF Chief of Immunization. Thank you for being with us. So as the world waits and prays for a vaccine to combat the current highly infectious novel coronavirus, this report on immunization rates is particularly alarming.
They tend to be in communities that are either conflict affected, a lot of conflict related breakdown of health systems, remote rural locations, which are hard to access or underserved by the health system, or among the urban poor. You're seeing large rates of urbanization in most developing countries, most low and middle income countries. And with this rural urban migration, you know, a lot of people, particularly the most vulnerable, the poorest of the lot, end up living in urban slums, which are not well serviced by the health system. This all is prior to the COVID-19 outbreak. And now, given the COVID outbreak and the fact that resources, human resources, attention is being diverted to address COVID outbreak, you know, there's going to be even further falls in immunization coverage globally.
One example of how serious this could be is Democratic Republic of Congo. They're battling one of the world's largest measles outbreaks, and they've got cholera, Ebola, rubella, and of course, as you mentioned, now this.
Absolutely. Countries with weak systems, they tend to be susceptible to obviously multiple health threats. It's not one disease or the other. They're at risk of outbreaks of a variety of diseases. So as you know, Lori, and you reported on this as well, you know, last year, DRC was struggling with an Ebola outbreak that made a lot of news globally. What went relatively unrecognized until much later is the fact that there was a concurrent measles outbreak as well, and actually killed more children than the Ebola outbreak did. You know, diseases go to places where, you know, they can. These countries with weak systems are, you know, susceptible to multiple health threats, and you need to look at it in its entirety and not, you know, one disease at a time.
Interesting, too, in your data, the United States topped the list for the largest number of children missing out on their first measles vaccine, 2.8 million children. That seems almost unheard of, given it's something that is accessible.
It is actually the accumulation of missed children, you know, across a number of years. I believe it's 2010 to 2018. So each year you're missing a cohort of children, and over years it builds up. And what happens is when it builds up, it creates what we call in a public health epidemiology term, a pool of susceptible children. When you have a highly vaccinated population, the virus has nowhere to go because everybody is protected. But when you have these pools of unsusceptible kids, you have a situation which is ripe for an outbreak. outbreak because the virus has a lot of susceptible kids to infect. This is indeed a pity, particularly when you see this in a high-income country with reasonably good health system. But Laura, you know, what vaccines have done is due to the relative success over the last several decades in, you know, reduction in number of cases of diseases like measles and diphtheria and polio. And you can understand the reasons for this. It's led to complacency. It's led to complacency from the side, from the part of the community, from the parents. These diseases are not seen as a threat anymore. You have not seen relatives and neighbors and kids from your community suffering from these diseases. So, you know, your threat perception is altered. Also from the healthcare provider, the physicians and nurses don't see the disease anymore. There's sometimes a tendency, you feel that the job is done and you take the foot off the gas and you miss kids and boom, you have an outbreak. As long as kids are born to this world, into a particular country, we can't take our foot off the pedal and we need to vaccinate year in, year after year after year.
Among these low-income countries with the measles vaccine coverage, even before COVID-19, as you said, between 2010 and 2018, I see Ethiopia with the highest number of children under the age of one who missed out. That's 10.9 million children. Is that because of inaccessibility?
A variety of reasons, Laurie. And again, you know, what I said earlier really holds true in a big country like Ethiopia. The reasons for non-vaccination among children is variable across the country. So in the big cities like Addis Ababa, you would see large proportion of missed children or children who don't receive vaccination in urban slums. You know, they tend to be, you know, poor populations, more recently arrived, migrated to the city, are not looped into the health system. You know, sometimes there are legality issues with the urban populations. They fear being identified by the local authorities, so they don't seek services. There are a lot of remote parts in Ethiopia that health services do not reach, the so-called underserved areas. And a third reason is there are parts of Ethiopia that are insecure, experiencing conflicts, so there's a disruption of health services there. You know, I think the point you mentioned earlier is really significant. We keep calling for a new vaccine or a new intervention. We don't have the same level of indignation that the fact that existing intervention, existing vaccines don't reach the kids that need them most. So the same thing will happen, you know, as and when there is a COVID vaccine, some of the most vulnerable children and communities will miss out because we can't reach them. So this is an opportunity. The limelight now, because of COVID, is on the importance of public health, the importance of preventive intervention, because prevention is easier to deal with than cure, as we are seeing now here, even with the COVID outbreak. You know, we need to, you know, make sure that immunization systems are effective in reaching those that reach them most. We have to put our resources and attention there. You know, as we recover from COVID, it's really important to catch up on the kids that missed vaccinations during the period of disruption due to COVID. Because what we don't want to happen in countries is as they are recovering from the COVID outbreak to have another outbreak of a vaccine preventable disease, which will further strain the health system and, you know, further jeopardize community and create completely unnecessary illnesses and deaths within these communities. So
it's Robin Nandy, UNICEF Chief of Immunization. Global confirmed coronavirus cases surpassed 3 million on Monday as many countries are now taking steps to ease lockdown measures that have brought the world to a standstill over the past 8 weeks. U.S. President Donald Trump Monday said he is rolling out a plan to reopen the country.
We're releasing additional guidance on testing to inform the states as they develop their plans for a phased and very safe reopening.
Trump again portrayed an optimistic outlook even as the United States nears 1 million cases.
There's a hunger for getting our country back, and it's happening, and it's happening faster than people would think.
More than 55,000 American lives have been lost in the coronavirus pandemic. Many Italians are displeased with the details provided by Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte regarding an end to the total coronavirus lockdown. They feel the government's concessions and measures that will characterize phase two are chaotic, lack logic, and don't go far enough and will further cripple the economy. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
Restrictions on Italians due to the coronavirus pandemic will start to be eased on May 4th, but very gradually, as the government is still fearful that the number of infections could easily rise again. Addressing the nation on live television Sunday evening, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte appealed to Italians to maintain their sense of responsibility during phase two, in which the country must coexist with the virus. During phase two, Conte said, it will be even more important to maintain social distancing, and fundamental will be the responsible behavior of each person. If you care about Italy, he added, you must avoid the spread of infections. The Prime Minister said Italians will now be allowed to meet family members, but only in small groups. They will still not be allowed to move from one Italian region to another unless they have a valid motivation for work or health matters, and everyone will still be required to carry a form explaining the reason for their travel. Parks will reopen and Italians will no longer be obliged to stay within close range of their homes. Factories and construction sites will be able to resume their activities, but bars and restaurants will only be able to provide takeaway service for the time being. Conte said no one will be returning to school until September. Parents were left wondering what they will do with their children. Many Italians have had enough of staying indoors for weeks and voiced their dissatisfaction with the decisions taken by the government. They do not understand the logic behind the different dates provided for reopenings. Why can museums open their doors on May 18th, but hairdressers not until June 1st? The Prime Minister stressed reopenings would require the full respect of security protocols. Italian right-wing politician Giorgia Meloni spoke shortly after the Prime Minister's Sunday evening address to the nation on live television and echoed the feelings of many in this country. She said that, like everyone else in Italy, she waited with great trepidation for the Prime Minister's details of phase two, expecting important announcements, only to discover there were hardly any changes at all.
Ci vorrebbe una logica. E la logica non può essere mai quella della discriminazione.
Meloni said there should be a logic, and the logic cannot be the discrimination of certain sectors. Why are some being helped and others left to die? She said Italians have for weeks accepted the government rules in the name of public health and to deal with this pandemic, but now they feel many of their rights are being trodden on.
Io non sono d'accordo sul fatto che alcuni non debbano riaprire.
Meloni said she did not agree that some cannot reopen for another month, because this will mean that some will never reopen. The state, she insisted, has not provided valid reasons for their decisions or the required financial assistance. Italy has had the highest number of deaths from coronavirus in Europe, with more than 26,000. There were 260 virus-related deaths in the last 24 hours, the lowest number in the past 6 weeks. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
While countries from Italy to New Zealand announced the easing of coronavirus lockdowns, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is back to work now following his hospitalization with the disease, said it's too early to relax restrictions there. Many countries are looking to ease lockdowns as rates of infections fall and fears of economic ruin rise. Lebanese have taken to the streets again, both in cars and on foot, to protest that country's deteriorating economic situation despite a lockdown and curfew imposed because of the coronavirus. The demonstrators say they're forced to choose between dying of hunger or disease. As Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, analysts predict a full-fledged catastrophe as huge pressure builds on the working and middle classes and refugees, who are the most vulnerable.
Warmer spring weather and job losses over the lockdown have brought angry Lebanese back to the streets in protests throughout the country. Some are blocking highways with burning tires. Health Minister Hamid Hassan warned that the demonstrations posed an imminent danger that will undermine all the achievements that have been made in containing the pandemic. He urged protesters to be careful, keep a distance, and wear masks so that they don't transfer the virus from the streets to their families, while expressing pain felt by every Lebanese citizen. Nationwide protests first erupted last October against the entire ruling class, accusing it of corruption and squandering public money. COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, has compounded Lebanon's financial woes. The Lebanese have seen the value of their savings tumbling, their currency plummeting, painful price increases, and job losses. Joseph Bahoud is an academic fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Lebanon, in real and in practical terms, was almost broken before the coronavirus reached it. The country completely in collapse and bankruptcy. Now, this translated in the liquidity crash, in the run towards the dollars, the hopeless policy of the central bank to try to defend the lira. And then the coronavirus came and completely shot the final bullet in economic activity. Now we're waiting to wake up after the coronavirus on a full-fledged catastrophe in the country.
Nasser Yassin is the interim director of the American University of Beirut's Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs.
This actually means there's a huge pressure on the working class and middle class, and of course on refugees, and those are the most vulnerable. We're going to see very, very dire situation in terms of people losing jobs. 55% of the Lebanese economy works in the informal sector. Around 97% of refugees work in the informal economy. Most of them, except the delivery sector, have been hugely affected by the lockdown. Some of them are trying to break the lockdown and look for jobs, and they've been faced by them. So this is one of the major repercussions.
One silver lining is that Lebanon has managed to contain the coronavirus outbreak relatively well, Yassin says. So far, the health ministry has reported 710 COVID-19 cases with 24 deaths. Del Gaflak for VOA News, Amman.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Construction workers were back at the burned shell of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris Monday, resuming the massive task of rebuilding after the coronavirus outbreak forced a month and a half long pause. The fire engulfed the 850-year-old building April 15th of last year. The flames destroyed the spire and roof and came within 30 minutes of razing the cathedral to the ground, according to officials. Lockdowns around Latin America are helping slow the spread of COVID-19, but are having a darker and less intended consequence. A spike in calls to helplines suggests a rise in domestic abuse in a region where almost 20 million women and girls suffer sexual and physical violence each year. In cities from Buenos Aires to Mexico City, Santiago, São Paulo, and La Paz, families and individuals have been confined in their homes in an unprecedented way, often only allowed out for emergencies or to shop for essentials. And South Korean officials say they have not detected any unusual movements in North Korea and are cautioning against reports that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un may be ill or is being isolated because of coronavirus concerns. At a closed-door forum on Sunday, South Korea's unification ministry, who oversees engagement with the North, said the government has the intelligence capabilities to say with confidence that there are no indications of anything unusual. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The personal and societal threat posed by the coronavirus pandemic everywhere in the world is dramatic and undeniable. However, scientists say the suffering caused by COVID-19 may be just a mild preview of what climate change may bring in the coming decades. especially in Africa. To compare and contrast the two, one immediate, the other on a slow burn, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke by Zoom with Columbia University's Jerry Arad, professor of environmental law at Columbia University Law School and director of the university's Sabin Center for Climate Change Law.
Well, I think one lesson of both the coronavirus crisis and the climate crisis is that we need to listen seriously to the warnings given to us by scientists, to do everything we can to reduce the hazards that they are telling us may happen, and to prepare to cope with the negative impacts that may happen regardless of our best efforts.
You told me that this isn't just a scientific question for you.
Well, I have a little granddaughter who was born in 2018, and I worry a great deal about what kind of world she is going to grow up in. And the reaction by a number of countries, especially the U.S., to the coronavirus is making me even more worried.
What are some of the future effects of climate change that really keep you up at night?
For instance, there are going to be parts of the world experiencing extreme heat, so bad that you can't really survive long outside, even in the shade. You have to go in for air conditioning, and if you don't have air conditioning, you're really in trouble.
And of course, we expect a drastic rise in sea levels, which has already begun.
That's right. One of the almost certain impacts that climate change will have is a large increase in the number of people who can no longer live where they've been living because of sea level rise, and they'll need to move. We may have hundreds of thousands or even millions, or under some projections, tens of millions of people who will need to move away from their traditional homeland. And where are they going to go? Who will let them in? Are the developed countries, including the U.S., going to just erect walls and machine gun nests, or are they going to show their humanity and let some people in?
What's the outlook for Africa specifically?
Africa is one of the parts of the world that is most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Extreme heat, drought, desertification, sea level rise along the coastlines. The current locust swarms may have been worsened by changes in climate. And of course, Africa is also the continent that has the lowest amount of surplus economic capacity to deal with all of these problems. It's also an area of the world that is likely to face rapid population growth. So the combination of all of these things creates very, very serious problems.
How do you compare the experience of the coronavirus threat with the even greater threat that severe climate change has for us down the road?
One would think that it is easier in one sense for society to deal with the coronavirus because it's an immediate problem that is right there. Climate change tends to be more remote in time, but both of them show the shortcomings in the ability of many societies around the world to deal with threatened hazards. A similarity is that the climate crisis is in large part because we have such a interconnected and economically vibrant world and economies that have grown up around very heavy use of fossil fuels to move people and goods all around the world. Now, that has had very good impacts in lifting many people around the world out of poverty, but on the other hand, it has led to tremendous greenhouse gas emissions, which are going to endanger everyone. Likewise, if we still had a disconnected society, a virus like this would have stayed put. But because everybody is moving around the world all the time, the virus spreads globally. So that's another similarity between the two crises.
Do you think the coronavirus pandemic will actually be a real climate change wake-up call for the Earth's people and their leaders especially?
Well, I'd like to believe that, but we've seen the distressing partisan divisions even over the coronavirus. We had hoped that this kind of crisis would bring people together, but it seems to be continuing to drive us apart.
Any parting words of advice for us?
I think the most important thing is really listen closely to the scientists. Don't let the politicians get ahead of the scientists. Listen to what the scientists have to say and act on it.
Elderly people are believed to be especially susceptible to the coronavirus. As a result, many senior living facilities have been on lockdown mode, not allowing visitors in order to protect the residents. But experts say the social isolation could lead to feelings of loneliness for many seniors. One virtual reality company, MindVR, is donating virtual reality headsets to all 50 U.S. states to keep seniors engaged. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on the potential benefits of a virtual reality experience.
So have a seat right here.
75-year-old Eileen Higa is about to embark on a new experience.
So go ahead and put the headset over your head.
When she puts on this headset, the four walls around her disappear, and she can fly.
I never done flying like that, so that was really fun.
Virtual reality, or VR, not only allows Higa to fly, it transports her to far-off places like Bali.
Mobile frame ceremonies to the water goddess.
And it lets her listen to a concert from her front row seat. She can even share her VR experience with her son, Kevin Higa.
Seeing it in my mom that when she does it, she's happy and excited. She likes it. She likes going places, so she gets to do that. And it's a cool thing.
Eileen Higa lives at Silverado Beverly Place, a memory care community for seniors affected by Alzheimer's or other disorders caused by dementia. Her son suggested she move here.
Increasingly over the last few years, noticing first minor memory issues and then bigger things and even bigger things. A lot of concerns and a lot of worries with her living alone with the Alzheimer's and the dementia.
VR is offered in some senior living communities through Mind VR, a company that places content ideal for the elderly in virtual libraries for assisted living communities. The communities see VR as a way of treating the symptoms of dementia without having to use drugs, which comes with side effects. In a small pilot study, some Mind VR participants felt dizzy, while others responded positively to the experience. Kim Buttram is Senior Vice President for Clinical Services at Silverado.
It seemed like it improved their mood. We saw less depression, a little less anxiety later in the day.
Researchers are looking into the benefits of virtual reality as a tool to fight isolation and loneliness linked to physical and mental conditions such as cognitive decline. Studies have found social isolation to be associated with a higher risk of mortality. Could VR provide quality of life for its residents?
We're not sure where it's going to lead, and that's why we're excited to be moving forward with this. Even to someone living on hospice, you know, what if when they're in bed and maybe too frail to get up and participate in the life of the community, but that they could see somewhere they went with their loved one and a trip to Paris again.
Without question, Eileen Higa liked her virtual reality experience.
You could do something that, you know, you want to do, but you can't do it, so it was great.
So, come on.
And through the magic of VR, Higa plans to keep experiencing new things and traveling to exotic places in this next chapter of her life.
That's fun.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Okay.
Michelle Obama's tour to promote her best-selling 2018 memoir, Becoming, has been turned into a documentary film for Netflix. Becoming, a behind-the-scenes look at the former First Lady's 34-city tour, will be released on May 6th. Obama and Netflix made the announcement in a statement on Monday. Auction house Sotheby's is offering a unique slate of experiences next month. On offer is an acting lesson with Patrick Stewart, coffee with Hillary Clinton, or songwriting advice from none other than Sting. The event will be held May 1st through 8th and will benefit the International Rescue Committee's efforts to combat COVID-19. Other experiences being auctioned will include a video conversation with Sacha Baron Cohen, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, or Apollo 9 astronaut Russell Schweikart.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care and be well.
This is VOA.